You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, from her powerful speeches to her chosen role as first mom, we look at the meaning of Michelle Obama.
First, today, Em Adams received an award for her work with Freedom, Inc., a grassroots nonprofit that seeks to end violence within and against low-income communities of color. She's also a co-founder of the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition. She's known internationally for her work as a U.S. delegate to the United Nations 2014 Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. She was also part of the first delegation to the White House for the LGBT Leaders of Color Summit.
Em joins us now to talk about her work here in Wisconsin. She's co-executive director of Freedom, Inc. Em, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, about the work that you're doing at Freedom, Inc. What kind of things do you do?
So Freedom, Inc.'s mission is to end violence within and against low-income communities of color, and we define violence very broadly. So that includes interpersonal examples of it, like sexual assault and domestic violence, and also systems violence, like capitalism and racism, and also police violence. And so a lot of my work is really engaging with folks in community, women, queer folks, and young folks, and building power where we can go out and create change around that violence.
It's interesting that you work within and against, because a lot of times people will argue that you have to do one or the other. If somebody talks about, say, police shootings, someone will say, oh, what about violence within African-American communities and vice versa? We've had callers say both on the show. Why is it so important to focus on both?
It's important to focus on both, because if you value Black life, if you think that Black communities should be thriving, you have to address both, because both of those our threats. And I think what allows us to do both in ways of integrity is that we understand that the root causes of both are the same. And so given colonialism, racism, white supremacy, and a whole host of other issues, there's violence against us. And that violence happens within that community and also structurally from the from other sectors of life. But this is why we have to fight both adamantly so.
And I've seen you quoted elsewhere saying that ending racial prejudice, the attitudes of prejudice, isn't necessarily the top priority. It would be a good thing, but it's not the most important thing. Why is that?
Yes. So Kwame Ture, also known as Stokely Carmichael, said, if a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. But if the white man has the power to lynch me, that's my problem. And so though we think addressing racial prejudice is incredibly important, because I think people should love Black people. I love Black people. So it'd be great if everybody loved Black people. But in addition to attitude, or even what we say is even more important than attitude, is the ability to impact Black people. And so we believe that whether or not you convince someone to like you, you should have enough power. There should be enough structure around you, the culture around you, the systems around you to nurture and give you opportunity to thrive, whether or not someone likes you. And so that's why we challenge people to say, hey, not only should you be thinking about attitudes, or attitudes alone won't do it, instead you should be thinking about power and structure. So how do we keep Black people safe? How do we keep Black people alive, whether or not Black people are liked necessarily by people?
So how do you do that? Working with low-income communities of color, how do you empower them in that way?
So we, the majority of our work is in leadership development. So we've developed a host of culturally specific programs that are generation specific and also gender specific that really looks at the person's whole life comprehensively. So we have particular services around getting people to help manage the crisis that they're experiencing, whether that be domestic violence services, sexual assault services, or other services needed. And then we also have culturally specific programs that really looks at, okay, so how is my personal life connected to broader issues of social change? And we really politicize people that way. And then we test it all out. We develop grassroots campaigns that target real issues in people's lives, but also are really examples or show the way that people and communities are building power. And so that's our approach. And so we work within communities by people most vulnerable and people who are targeted in violence. And then we work with folks, the folks who have a sense of their own power, and then they go out and create change.
We don't
wait for other people to do it for us.
We're talking to Em Adams, co-executive director of the group Freedom, Inc. And Em, I understand, I've been saying sort of generically low-income communities of color, but you reach out to particular groups, gender, sexual orientation. Why is it important to focus especially on people who might be doubly disempowered in some ways?
Because we know that if you solve the issues for folks who are most vulnerable, for people who have multiple identities that are oppressed, so women, black queer people, black folks with disabilities, black low-income folks, et cetera, we know that if you create a world and create systems that are not violent towards them, that you solve the issues for everybody. But you could very well solve the issues for just a small sector of the community, if those not most marginalized and everyone else would still be suffering. And so we focus on those who are most vulnerable to system and interpersonal attack.
As you work individually with people, as you say, to help build their innate power of leadership, what changes? What kind of things do you hear from them as they go through this?
We hear people have a lot more agency in their own lives, so really having a sense of their power to create change in the still in the communities that they're in. Because, for example, Freedom Inc. is not we are not resource rich in the sense that we will be able to financially pull people out of economic crisis. That's not our work. We don't have enough money to just dump a lot of money in the community. Instead, we work with people to understand how poverty, how capitalism are systems that are targeted towards them. And so people begin to engage in alternative structures. So people begin to look at, okay, how can our community be resilient under capitalism instead of just falling in the same sort of ways that the system is hurting folks. So some of our members have gone on to create cooperatives, for example. So you hear people say things like, oh, now I understand this way. Here's an alternative. Here's a creative way that I'm going to be resilient and withstand the conditions that we are experiencing. So we hear a lot of stories and testimonies that way. And then another thing that we see in here is people go into the community and begin to bring in their friends and families because they found such empowerment within the organization.
These are issues that have been around for literally centuries. They're global. They're huge. Are you able to find victories working at the community level, at this local level?
Absolutely. So you're absolutely right. These are issues that have been around long before we've been here. So we don't believe that we're going to single-handedly uproot them. But so we understand what our victories could be in a number of ways. So one, there's been a host of local policy issues that we've impacted. So in 2010, 2011, a lot of our work with Take Back the Land has affected local policy around housing, local policy around food, as we created more housing options, more options around land for urban gardening. So in addition to local policy, we also see a change in our folks. Because these are long and deep-seated issues, it's going to take a movement to undo them. And movement work is lifelong work. So what we also measure, which is incredibly important to us, is the number of new leaders that we see emerging, or the number of folks who are women, queer folks, folks with disabilities, who are emerging and really showing leadership and going out and actually organizing and creating change. And so measuring that type of power is also a huge victory to us.
What are some of your goals in this new year, in 2017?
Our goals are that which they were before. Certainly the Texas thing, given the new administration that is coming up in the next few days. So there are lots of considerations. There are going to be details and strategies that need to shift, but our overall goals around black liberation are the same. And so when folks say, what are you going to do now, or what are you fighting for? We're fighting for the same things, but how we fight and the barriers and the obstacles will look different, but the goal is still the same, black liberation.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was M. Adams, co-executive director of Freedom Inc., a grassroots nonprofit that seeks to end violence within and against low-income communities of color. As the Obama family prepares to leave the White House after 8 years, our next guest asked 16 writers to share what First Lady Michelle Obama means to them. Michelle, as she's simply known by her admirers, has been an unusually popular First Lady and one who made her mark in the arenas of children's health, political speeches, fashion, and more. And our next guest says the first African-American First Lady did things on her own terms.
But I think it's all an evolutionary process. You grow into this role, and my sense is that you never get comfortable if you're always pushing for change and growth, not just in yourself, but in the issues that you care about. You're never done, so there's never a point in time where you feel like, there, I am now here, and I can do this the same way all the time. It's always changing.
Michelle Obama talking about her role as First Lady. Veronica Chambers joins us now. She's a writer and former senior editor at the New York Times Magazine and the editor of the book, The Meaning of Michelle, 16 Writers on the Iconic First Lady and How Her Journey Inspires Our Own. Veronica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, when did you realize that Michelle Obama was going to be someone who was special to you and also to a lot of other people?
Well, I think I've been a Michelle fan since the very first campaign. And about a year ago, my editor and I, we were out to lunch, and she said, "Don't you want to do a book?" And I thought, well, if we're going to do a book that's going to happen in a year, we have to do it fast. And we did. And it was really great to be able to pull together this tribute to this really iconic First Lady.
Well, a thread running through this book of essays, people said they kind of felt like they knew Michelle Obama. Some writers called her Shell, you know, even yeah. shortening from the first name to just Shell. Why do you think that is, that feeling of intimacy with someone?
Well, you know, I think that she has been, for someone who was hesitant to take the role, she has been someone who has really embraced it and in turn embraced the people who've come into contact with her. I mean, I've never met her personally, but, you know, you read a lot about her hugs. And several of the writers, Philippa Sue, Alicia Hall Moran, Marcus Samuelson, have met her. And they say, you know, when she hugs you, it's not a fake hug. It is a real embrace. There's a real feeling that there's nobody else in the room but you, and this moment is happening in a really personal way. And I think somehow that's been communicated to our whole country.
And one of the essayists said that she actually cried when she read a piece about Michelle Obama's, I think it was, inauguration dress in the New York Times. And her husband said, "Well, why are you crying?" And she said, "Because she's like me." Can you tell us a little more about Michelle Obama's background?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, we know from the president's farewell speech, he reminded us she's a girl from the South Side. She had working class parents. Her dad had a disability, and yet he worked every day of his life so that he could pay for her to go to school. And so, you know, she came from a humble background, and yet she excelled at Princeton. She went to Harvard Law School. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, I think despite the polarity of, you know, the past campaign cycle, she really does represent the American dream. And I think that the fans of her really recognize that in her, someone humble who made it really, really far based on hard work and a lot of family love.
And it sounds like that really spoke to a lot of people, this feeling that in a way that they could have been her, that maybe their children could be her, someone who works hard and ends up in the White House.
I mean, I feel like as a mother of a young daughter, I could not have, like, you know, like those, if you think about the Disney princesses and the fairy godmothers, I mean, I feel like Michelle Obama has been like a fairy godmother to my daughter. Because for a girl like my daughter who has brown skin, and the fact that the only First Lady she knows is Michelle Obama is incredible. My daughter literally feels like she's like a real-life superhero, as well she should.
And in the book, we hear about how Michelle Obama took her first tour of the White House, and she chose to wear a red dress, and that was a bold choice. I mean, what did that striking fashion sense of hers mean to African-American women especially?
I think that there's been a great moment with Michelle Obama's fashion. There's two things that I think are constantly happening, is that I think she really goes for the broadest possible reach. You know, wearing a red dress when you're from a blue party is saying, I am here to represent all people, and I'm reaching across the aisle, even sartorially, at least it did to me. But I also think it means one of the things is that it's been a long, long, long time since we've had a candidate and a president who's gone through 8 years without any hint of scandal, without any sort of misstep. And so it also, the bold fashion choices said, I take this role really seriously. And I'm going to, you know, one of the essays called it dressing like you mean it. And so there's a sense that I'm not going to be sloppy, and it extends to the fashion.
Do you think that we talk too much about the fashion choices of first ladies. I mean, there was Michelle Obama's fashion sense. There was a lot of focus on her arms and how toned they were, and people, that was a thing for a long time. Do you think it detracts at all from the work that a first lady does?
I do. I think that the whole campaign of ask her something else besides what she's wearing that's been happening on red carpets is important, because we don't ask men what they wear. And, you know, President Obama talked about the fact that he basically had a uniform and he wore very similar things so that he didn't have to think about it. I think what Michelle Obama did, which was so interesting, is that she really, because she knew people would be watching what she wore young designers, she wore designers of really different backgrounds, and that was a big boon. There was a study by NYU Business School that showed that her influence on brands, if she wore a brand consistently, it was worth $38 million to that brand. So brands like J. Crew actually enjoyed an economic boost, which is really different than, you know, if someone sees Jennifer Lawrence or Beyonce wearing something, they don't necessarily go online and get it. But if the first lady wore a really pretty sheath dress to a president's address, it might sell out before the time he finished speaking. Mm. So there was a sense that she was a role model as a career woman, as someone who was, you know, a woman of a certain age, and her clothes she chose were really wearable.
We're talking with Veronica Chambers right now as the Obama family prepares to leave the White House. We're talking about her book. It's called The Meaning of Michelle, 16 Writers on the Iconic First Lady and How Her Journey Inspires Our Own. And Veronica, you talk about different ways of perceiving the strength of Michelle Obama. A lot of the essayists in the book focus on that. I mean, there are her arms as sort of a metaphor, but there's also her relationship with Barack Obama and her voice as someone who spoke up about various issues that she cared about, including the Bring Back Our Girls campaign that she was part of. How would you describe her strength?
I think that the power of her strength was that, first of all, she wielded it very carefully. You know, she took her time, and she started, what I love about what she did is she literally started in the ground with the garden, you know, the first White House garden since the days of Eleanor Roosevelt. So you get the sense that this whole idea of planting and a harvest was a very powerful metaphor, because I think as she went on step by step, she took on more and took bolder moves and initiatives, but she didn't just kind of jump into everything, which is, in this age of social media, it can be easy to retweet everything, to post everything, to say, I'm for this, I believe in this, support this too. She really grew along the way. The clip that you played was so brilliant because she talked about it changes every day, but she also changed and grew in the role.
Do you think that she succeeded in reaching people who may not have been Democrats? Did she have that kind of sort of bipartisan appeal?
I think that she did. You know, it's been interesting for me. One of the people that ended up reaching out to me was someone who I went to college with, who is a very conservative columnist. And he said to me, you know, we didn't talk much at college. And he goes, I'm going to talk about her detractors, because at the end of the day, the fact is even the president-elect, if you look at him, he hasn't really criticized her. And I think that's huge. He's criticized basically everybody. And I think that people believe she comes from a good place and that she's not taking hits against them. And so there's been very, very few hits against her, which is pretty amazing.
There's also an area in the book where it's discussed about her choice, calling herself first mom, not, you know, other options that she could have had that had more reference to her law degree from Harvard or, you know, something else about her Ivy League education, but first mom. What did that choice mean?
You know, it's interesting because I think that for some people, the idea of calling yourself first mom or mom in chief was a betrayal, but I think that she was saying, my first job in this is to really get my family settled and to figure out how we keep working and growing, because I think that she knew from the moment they entered the White House, there would be a day when they would leave the White House, and what she wanted was for her kids to be strong and confident. She wanted her marriage to be secure and stronger than ever before, and I think that she was signaling, that is my priority, and And the fact is that that's the foundation upon which most of our lives are built. You know, there was a study that showed that people, the president called her in his farewell address, his best friend. And people who feel like they are married to their best friends are not only healthier and do better economically, but are happier. And so I think she was saying, I'm putting my happiness first above everything else. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
Now, it sounds like she may still be an influential figure when she leaves the White House, too. There are people out there who hope she's going to get into politics, that she could be a leader in that respect, too. What do you hope that she does in her new life post-White House?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there was a hashtag Michelle 2020, and that was a pretty exciting hashtag if you're a fan of hers. But she has said again and again that she does not want to run for office. That said, I do think that she has proven herself to be a really dedicated public servant. You know, the Let Girls Learn initiative that she started with the Peace Corps, it has been, I think, amazing. The fact that 62 million girls around the world who are school age, my daughter's age and slightly older, who should be in school aren't. They work in factories or they're in child marriages. And she's really looking at that kind of global effect of how can we just do the basics of getting girls in school and letting them get the education that they need and deserve, and how will the world be shaped by that? And I think that's pretty powerful.
Veronica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great. Really nice talking to you.
That was Veronica Chambers, writer and former senior editor at the New York Times Magazine, and she's the editor of the new book, The Meaning of Michelle, 16 writers on the iconic First Lady and how her journey inspires our own. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's investigative reporting with Reveal. This week, next to the air we breathe, it's the planet's most precious resource, fresh water, and it's disappearing. Find out more tonight after 7 on Reveal here on the Ideas Network.
First, according to an updated study from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, Wisconsin is one of the worst states in the country for racial disparities.
These disparities range from high unemployment rates, lower income rates, to a lack of educational opportunities. Wisconsin also has disproportionate rates of incarceration among African Americans.
Laura Dresser is with us. She's the Associate Director for COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, Laura, overall, how does Wisconsin stack up in this latest report when it comes to racial disparities in the state?
Well, it's a pretty grim picture. It's not, if anybody's been paying attention to racial inequality, then you would know that Wisconsin regularly ranks among the worst in the nation on all kinds of indicators, from unemployment to income to educational outcomes to incarceration. We've updated the data, and that picture is pretty consistent. So pretty bad news across the board in terms of the distance between the black and white populations.
And you say in the report, as you say here, that it is bad news, but you also say that these numbers are not inevitable. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, one of the things I think, there's kind of two inevitabilities that people think. One is if you tell people that there's racial inequality in the state, they sort of will think, well, that's true everywhere. And what part of what this report does is point out is, no, it's actually worse in Wisconsin. But the other inevitability thing that people don't know is that in 1979, for example, it wasn't worse in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin in 1979, African-American outcomes were above the national averages, not well below them. And so the disparity was much smaller in 1979. The restructuring that has happened to the Wisconsin economy has disproportionately driven that wedge apart and left African Americans further behind whites.
So given that that change, clearly something has shifted in Wisconsin. So let's start up by looking at the economic numbers, starting with unemployment. What did you see there?
Well, in unemployment, 10% of the black population in the state reports that they are actively seeking work and cannot find work. So when you hear talk of how low unemployment rates are, and they are generally around 4% or just below, That's true of the overall population, but the black unemployment rate is nearly three times higher. And again, there's only two states, Connecticut and Minnesota, where the ratio between the black unemployment rate and the white unemployment rate is so wide, is wider than our disparity.
As we go along, we'll see as we talk through some of these numbers that Minnesota often comes up as a state where it's also not a great picture with a lot of these measures that we're discussing. Sometimes Minnesota's a little worse. Have you drawn any parallels to what's happening in Minnesota and Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is an interesting question and a hard one. In many ways, the performance over the last 30 years of the state of Minnesota is much more dynamic. The income numbers are better. The general economic measures tend to have diverged from the state's economic measures, from Wisconsin's. And so that puts Minnesota on a higher platform in a lot of ways if you look over the last 10 years or so. But they also, as you point out, generate a lot of inequality between black and white populations. And I don't have a single answer for that. I know that most of the answers in Wisconsin are driven out of the economic restructuring in Milwaukee and the Lakeshore. The majority of the black population in the state lives in Milwaukee or just south of Milwaukee. And the inequality that grew there in manufacturing really, I think, started much of the force that pushed this giant divide between whites and blacks in this state. That story, I'm sure, is not the same in Minnesota. It's never had a manufacturing core the way Milwaukee did. But I don't know if it is. I don't know the story there as well.
So when you talk about restructuring in Milwaukee, are you talking about a disappearance of manufacturing jobs in general in Milwaukee, or that African Americans were somehow pushed out of that manufacturing job market?
I think there's a few things going on with manufacturing in Milwaukee. One is Milwaukee manufacturing declined. There are fewer jobs in the city than there used to be. And the jobs that exist are not as often the higher wage union jobs. African Americans in Milwaukee did get into higher wage manufacturing union jobs, but as more recently hired cohort, as that sector, as manufacturing declined and those union shops declined, then the last hired were the first let go. So I think they were on the front edge of the shrinking of that industry. And then as well, a lot of manufacturing sits just outside the city of Milwaukee, and there's very serious problems, both in practical terms in transportation, but also in terms of the kind of heavy segregation of the community and the resistance of white communities to black workers coming in. And so then there was a set of jobs outside of the central city that workers were either by transportation or by more structural racism could not get to those jobs. And then also the most dynamic growth in the Milwaukee region has been outside the city. And so then those opportunities have also been hard to get to.
Laura Dresser is with us right now talking about a new report that details racial disparities in Wisconsin. She's the associate director for COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. And Laura, let's look at another measure in your report, labor force participation. What do you see there?
Well, Wisconsin's a state of a lot of labor force participation, and so you see pretty high levels of labor force participation in the state. But the black rate of labor force participation is lower, significantly lower than the white rate. And so that disparity, again, we're always measuring the disparity. And in Wisconsin, we end up looking good because the white population in the state does pretty well relative to national averages. Generally, the black population in the state does pretty poorly relative to national averages. That means our disparity is big. Anyway, so that disparity is that African Americans, about 6 in 10 are in the labor force, and whites are much more likely to be in the labor force. And that In fact, actually, though, if you look at the state of Washington, African Americans are more likely to work than whites. This is one where it isn't always true that the state generates a lower rate of participation for blacks than whites. But Wisconsin, Illinois, Wisconsin and Illinois have the highest disparity between white and black labor force participation, just being working.
And jumping around a little bit, one area where the disparities are not quite as stark, health insurance coverage.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Wisconsin actually has had for, 20 years or more, a very high level of health care coverage. And we have that high level of health care coverage because our private system has been pretty well developed. Most employers continue to provide health insurance through their job, through work. But then also our public system was very generous. We were early on getting children included through the CHIP program and other ways. That generosity of the public side has been restricted a bit over the last, over the refusal to accept Obamacare. So not as true now. But anyway, we've always had high rates of healthcare coverage. And in fact, the disparity between white and black isn't as bad either. So that coverage has been meaningful and helps close that gap for the African American population. Still, this is better because we're not one or two or three worse in the nation, but we're seventh. The disparity is the seventh highest level in the nation. So it's still, in the worst fifth.
And you mentioned that this is an updated report. I mean, are there any signs that the needle is moving in the right direction? A lot of it you said is bad news, but are there any glimmers there?
I think the one that we saw the move the most this year is that, in fact, in 2014, and quite distressingly, the black unemployment rate in the state was the highest in the nation, just in absolute terms. And that isn't true anymore. We're not generating the highest level of black unemployment in the nation. And I think that's a place, seeing that move matters a lot, because the other economic indicators, the poverty, the child poverty, those are all going to hinge back on that employment. And so to see that one move away from the worst in the nation is probably what I thought of as the best piece of news.
We're talking with Laura Dresser right now about racial disparities in the state and what can be done to alleviate them. She's the associate director for COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, which recently released an updated report on this issue.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and maybe experiences. Do you see this gap here in Wisconsin on a daily basis? What do you think accounts for this? What do you think should be done to address some of these disparities economically between black and white people in Wisconsin? What programs have or haven't worked in the state? What do you think we need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about racial disparities in Wisconsin and Wisconsin's economy with Laura Dresser, Associate Director for COWS, formerly the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. They just released a new report on the topic.
And we'd like to hear from you. What would you like to see change in the state? How do you think the state should narrow these racial disparities? Are you seeing this at play in your own community? And what do you think could help? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We have David joining us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a lawyer. I own a small law practice, but when we look for employees, it's very difficult to find employees, at least in the Milwaukee area, of color who have the educational background we're looking for. And I started to research the schools in Milwaukee and the suburbs, and I found that almost every school that's underperforming has, as a majority, students who come from a single-parent background or home. And I found that almost all of the overperforming or performing schools have, as a majority, children who come from two-parent homes. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't be focusing our time, our commitment, our energy to helping build the family structure that seems, at least statistically, to make for better schools, which then in turn could produce students, better students, and employees who may meet the requirements we need in terms of education.
And David, David, thank you so much for your thoughts, and David getting at a line of reasoning other people have brought up as well, looking at the family structure. And I know your report gets into education as well, Laura, but what do you say to David?
I think it's an important point and good one to think about. I think there are really extreme disparities in economic performance. But, of course, a lot of these disparities are tying back not only to family, but also to poverty and the extreme inequality in different communities. And so I know that there have been some attempts to take on issues of strengthening the family. I think it tends to be so intertwined with issues of poverty. I don't think you get to solve the problem when nobody has work and nobody has money. Families isn't the only answer. We need to think hard also about economic opportunity and poverty and how much schools can make up for when the students are coming to school without sufficient food or with stressed and distracted parents, whether it's one or two parents. But the stress in the home and the lack of the ability to kind of support the education from the home comes not only because of the family structure, but also because of the jobs the parents have not paying enough to be able to have the parent really engage in the child's education as well. So there's a lot of things going on, obviously. There's not a single answer, but I would look to that whole mix, thinking about poverty, family structure, and parents' jobs and the way parents can engage with school when they're so stressed and unable to make ends meet.
And Laura, your report does look at measures of poverty, median household income, and child poverty. Let's dig in a little there. What did you see?
Well, you know, I think one that's interesting is the median household income. And this is just for all households. So this includes people who work and people who don't work. It includes seniors, and it includes, you know, everything is a household. It's just people in living units. So it's not just families, but households. And the median household income in the state is about $55,000. For whites, it's $58,000 annual income. For blacks, it's half that, $29,000. And so strength and I think most folks who are living close to or below $29,000 know the kind of stress and problems that lower income, if you have kids, can lead to, and the kind of questions about the quality of living, the safety of your neighborhood, the ability to pay for medications, even if you have health insurance, or even engage with health care at all if you don't have health insurance, all that very hard at $29,000 a year. And that is what the median, exactly halfway through the black population, income is. That's, that 50% puts us third lowest, or the third greatest disparity in the nation.
Now, what about metrics of child poverty?
If you look at kids, then you see that the ratio, the disparity between black and white kids, like just over 1 in 10 white kids in the state live in poverty. 4 in 10, more than 4 in 10 African-American children in the state live in poverty. So the disparity between the two, black kids are almost 4 times more likely than white children to live in poverty in the state. This is another one where Minnesota is worse, has a higher disparity than we do. But even just going back to that 44%, 4 in 10 kids, black kids in this state, are living in poverty, living in situations where getting to the end of the month, getting food on the table, health care, and utilities are all very hard questions, let alone thinking about education.
Laura Dresser from COWS is with us now talking about racial disparities in the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin struggling in most measures when it comes to disparities, poverty and jobs and incarceration, all things that Wisconsin needs to work on. And Laura, you were talking about those poverty measures there and how that struggle can impact a family, and that carries over to the educational experience that the kid can have and how involved the parents can be. And it brings us to how you talk about in your report the need for multifaceted solutions and approaches. What kinds of things do you think would help here?
Well, I think, it is clear there are so many things going on. It isn't an easy silver bullet. If only we took care of this or that, this would all turn around. I think that lesson that back in 1979, this disparity didn't exist. The disparity existed, but we weren't worse than the nation, right? So I don't want to say that that wasn't a problem in 1979. It wasn't that things were equal. It's just that Wisconsin didn't stand out for being more unequal. But that was built on, economic opportunity for African Americans and the wages and quality of jobs that they had. It all, I think, started there. And with, real attention to the economic development of the city of Milwaukee and real attention to the institutions that build the human capital of the people of the city of Milwaukee. Those two things, I think, many people can agree on and are essential to solving this problem. Thinking also about taking on questions of the discrimination that may happen in employers and these questions of transportation and people's housing segregation or ability to get to places where work is available, I think is also critical in this state because there is such a legacy of disparity and racism to take on.
And so looking at those first steps, what is one solid first step that you think could happen maybe policy-wise or at a different level to help?
I think thinking about what we're doing about the Milwaukee schools matters, thinking about investing in them and trying to make the schools work. I think a lot of people agree on that one. The Milwaukee schools is a central question. The Milwaukee economy and making sure we're building skills among workers who need better opportunity for the best possible jobs. The workforce development system in Milwaukee and the workforce development board and the technical college there are another important place for investment. And then the transportation system in Milwaukee to help people who can't afford cars get to where the jobs are. I would guess maybe somewhere we could start there.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Laura Dresser, Associate Director for COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. And she was with us today to talk about an updated report that COWS released about racial disparities in the state and maybe what solutions can be put into place to help to begin to close that gap.
You can read that report from COWS on the Central Time Facebook page.